Okay, a couple of things I wanted to mention to you. Number one is your field guides that you guys have been working on. Those are due today. If you don't have it right now, just bring it by my office anytime today is fine, okay? And as I mentioned before, what I'm gonna do is take those and I'll look them over and I maybe offer a few suggestions on something that you might wanna consider adding and then give them back to you. And then you can fix them up however you want. And hopefully they'd be ready to go here sometime soon. So you can actually get some use out of them. The other thing is the rescheduled test is gonna be Thursday. And so we'll just meet in this room at 1:30. And I think most people probably only need about a half hour to do it, something like that. It's not a real lengthy one. And then we will have lab on Thursday afternoon afterwards. It's not a real long one, but it's related to parent materials, something we're going to be talking about today. And part of it's just show and tell, some different types of rocks, and then a couple exercises for you to do. But it shouldn't be a lengthy lab at all. This week, what we're going to do today and Thursday in lecture here is finish up the five soil forming factors. We've covered climate and organisms, and we need to, today we'll do relief and probably get started on parent material and then finish up on Thursday with time as a soil forming factor. So that's kind of where things stand. One more note, there's a homework assignment up here for you to pick up, and this one's due a week from Thursday, so you got a little while to work on it. Okay. As we're working through these soil forming factors, the next one that we're going to consider is topography. And I've mentioned before, this isn't really a very good name for it, not a very apt description, but that's what Han Jenny decided to call it when he put together the soil forming, his model. But I think maybe a more accurate descriptor of what we mean by topography is probably landscape position. And it's really where a soil sits on the landscape. And there are a lot of different ways that you can talk about landscape position, especially now with technological advances and all the digital elevation models and things like that. There are just a whole bunch of ways that you can characterize landscape position. What we're going to do, though, is focus on four things, okay? One of them is going to be aspect, or the compass direction that a slope faces, slope gradient, and then we're going to talk a little bit about slope position and really slope configuration, two different aspects of that. And it'll be maybe a little clearer when we get show you some of this information. Well, the main thing about topography as a soil forming factor is that, and we talked about additions as being one of the basic processes. Well, topography has a big influence on soil formation because it redirects energy that comes into the soil, and that can be sun and gravity. And you'll see some examples of this. But it really is you think about the landscape position, is something that is going to, more than anything else, redirect solar energy and precip and things like that, and I'll show you examples. So if we start off, the first thing we're going to talk about is aspect. An aspect, as I mentioned, is simply the compass direction that a soil faces. This is a newer image right here, so you don't have it, in your notes. But I just put it on here because I think it's a pretty good way of illustrating the differential effects of aspect on something as simple as heat transfer into the soil or energy transfer. So the way this diagram works, south is to the right, okay, north is to the left, just like in real life here. So these slopes would all be south aspects, right? And this would be a north-facing slope. And this one's nearly level, so aspect is not so much of an issue there, okay? But here's the main effect of slope, and this has to do with slope gradient as well. But so here's the sun in the southern sky. This is a northern hemisphere centric view of things. But the idea is that each of these little figures that you see here represents equal cross-sectional areas of sunlight. And if you take this one on the right, it's striking the Earth on a south-facing slope, and the sunlight is pretty much at right angles to the surface. And what that means is that you are concentrating that solar energy in a relatively small area. And in terms of the heating and that sort of thing, energy transfer, that's where you're going to get the maximum amount. Now, this middle one shows the sunlight being distributed on a north-facing slope. It's the same cross-sectional area, but look what happens when we put it on that steep north-facing slope. It's spread out over a much greater area, and what that does is reduce the amount of heating that might take place. And so the basic idea here is that a south-facing slope is going to be a warmer slope than a north-facing slope. I don't think that's too surprising to anybody, but the big effect that has is not just on temperature, but something that we call effective precipitation. Because imagine on this landscape, I would argue that both of this soil and this soil right here, they get the same amount of annual precipitation, whether it's rain or snow. But what differs is the effective precipitation. And because of this aspect effect, there's going to be much less effective precipitation on that north-facing slope. And I'll show you some local examples. And this third one here just shows the sunlight hitting on a level surface, and they rate that as kind of intermediate heating. But the main difference here is between the north and the south aspects. Okay, this next image here that you do have, and this shows, it's a local view. Anybody recognize it? Yeah, as you get ready to go down the Lewiston grade, if you look off to the east, you'll see this. This is Hatway Creek, and you're looking pretty much due east. So on the right, you've got a north aspect, and on the left, you've got south aspect. Notice the difference in vegetation, okay? These slopes get the same amount of annual precip, 23, 24 inches. What is different, though, is the effective precipitation as governed by the aspect. The south aspect is going to be warmer and therefore drier. Look at the vegetation there. You can't really see what it is. Probably yellow star thistle and other cheatgrass. The north aspect actually has Douglas fir and ponderosa pine growing on it. So it good indicator of more effective precipitation there. And the other thing that you might notice around here this time of the year is the snow's melting. This is a view of some of the Palouse Hills, and you notice the little bands of snow that you see here. Well, in almost every case, that little snow drift, or what's left of that snow, is on a north-facing slope. And they tend to be kind of steep, but you can see that this is kind of a complicated phenomenon because of wind and the aspect and all of this, but the snow tends to sit in on the northern sides of these hills, and that snow may sit there for weeks after the snow has left the other area. So it's a lot, you're actually increasing the amount of precipitation or water moving into the soil there just because of the effect of drifting and so on. But back to the Lewiston grades example. The soil profile on the left is the south aspect. The soil profile on the right is the north aspect. And you can see the horizonation given there. What are some of the main differences that you notice? The same parent material, vegetation's different, but topography other than aspect, about the same percent slope and all that. What are some of the differences, and how would you explain them? Which is a deeper soil? Okay, the one on the north aspect, right? Because it doesn't have you don't see any R horizon in there. And what's the simplest explanation for deeper soil north aspect?
Because
Well, more weathering, just in general, more soil development, okay? Deeper soil profile. How about calcium carbonate? What's the story with that? Is it in both profiles? Okay, it's in the south aspect. Why? Okay, there's probably less water moving down through the south aspect. As a result, you're not getting the greater translocation, or in this, as you see in the north aspect, the removal of calcium carbonate. There's just not enough water percolating through to completely get rid of it. So in the south aspect, you've got a BK horizon. What about the amount of clay translocation and accumulation? You'll note the north aspect has a fairly thick BT horizon. The south aspect, not so much. Probably directly attributable to the amount of water moving down through the soil profile that's available for translocation of clays. And then you get into some more difficult differences. Probably a better expressed A horizon on the south aspect. The reason being it's primarily grass, and we talked about this last time, the difference between a forest soil where you get most of the inputs in the form of litter versus a grassland where it's mainly in the form of roots. But these are, you know, two fairly different soil profiles that are literally a stone's throw from one another, and you would, for, if you think about other soil forming factors besides the aspect, they would be very similar. You would expect them to be very similar. So pretty important influence of aspect. And this is something that you see in northern latitudes or southern latitudes. As you get towards the equator, the effects of aspect really don't manifest themselves very much. But really important at higher latitudes. We also see it in the forests around here. One of the things that we will typically see in the forest soils is a volcanic ash mantle. And we'll be looking at these a little later in the semester. But if you look at a north-facing slope, profile on the left, the ash mantle tends to be a little bit thicker in general. And if you look at a south-facing slope, the ash mantle may not be as thick. And the other thing is that the ash mantles on the south-facing slopes tend to be a lot more mixed. There's rock fragments in there. They're just not as pure as you might find on a north-facing slope. Any idea why that would be? Why would you expect more mixing on a south-facing slope? Okay, it's more exposure, and around here, what might go on a south-facing slope a lot more readily than north-facing slopes?
Turbation.
It could be turbation, yeah. But definitely disturbance. What about fire? Which of those slopes is going to be warmer and drier, effectively? The south-facing slope. So which is going to be more prone to burning on a more regular basis? Probably the south-facing slope. And once you burn either the canopy or the litter layer, it sort of sets up that volcanic ash mantle to be eroded or more mixed and that type of thing. So just much more active processes on south-facing slopes in terms of things that might mix up the soil a little bit. And this is a pattern that's repeated all over the forests in northeastern Washington, northern Idaho as well. So let's talk a little bit about the slope position, okay? And this is a figure out of your book. The one you might have is slightly different, but this is kind of the classic idea of a hill slope profile. And so you can see up here, they're calling it the position up top. It's called a crest or a summit. You see it both ways. And then this is relatively flat, and then you see this big change in slope gradient. We've got a shoulder, side slope, foot slope, toe slope, and floodplain out here, and eventually you get to a stream or a river. Now, not every single hill slope looks like this, but in general, it's a pretty good model that applies to a lot of them, and we can associate different sorts of processes with each of those landscape positions or hill slope positions that we see there. The other thing that we need to think about with regard to slope configuration is this idea of the plan view versus the cross-sectional view. And so this is a figure from that NRCS guide on describing soils. And what they're doing is breaking these slopes into actually two components. And they're looking at the slope shape in two directions. Up and down the slope, in other words, perpendicular to the contours. And then the second way is across the slope or along the horizontal contours. So what you can see are there are really nine different combinations of these different sorts of slope. You start up here in the upper left-hand corner, that's what we would call a linear slope. So the idea here is that if we look at it up and down the slope, that's fairly linear, in other words, as opposed to convex or concave. Same thing across the slope. And the idea here is that if you drew the contour lines on this slope, that they would be very much parallel to one another. And the net result is water movement. And that's what's indicated by these arrows, where you would get surface flow and even subsurface flow to some extent. So we get linear flow on this. Well, then you see the various combinations, but the V stands for convex, and the C stands for concave. And I guess the point here is that you could characterize these different slopes as either water collecting or water shedding slopes based on the flow paths, right? Wherever you see these arrows diverging, you're spreading water out over a larger area, and wherever you see these arrows converging, like here, then you're actually collecting water. And we've talked about how water is an important component of all these processes in terms of translocations and transformations and so on. So you can see how the slope shape or slope configuration is going to have an effect on water. And also, we talked about processes like cumulization, where you've got additions of mineral material, things like that. You'll see the same sorts of patterns there as related to the surface characteristics, where this set here on the right, where you're getting convergent flow, you probably will have accumulation of mineral material as well. On the convex slopes, where you're seeing divergent flow, you're probably going to expect to see less accumulation, probably more erosion or loss of mineral material. So, to the degree that you can do this in the field is look at a slope that you're on and determine the overall layout, and as far as is it linear, concave, or convex. It really gives you at least a better understanding of where water is moving. And then that's in turn going to tell us a lot about development. So the linear flow and what we call divergent flow, where you've got the convex type of situation, and then convergent flow would be this third column over here with the arrows coming together. Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about the landscape positions on that hill slope that I showed you and the types of processes that we associate with each one. And let's start off with the summit, or what was labeled as crest in that diagram. Now, the term summit may be a little bit misleading because people think of a mountain summit, a jagged peak, or something along those lines. But in the context that we're using it here, a summit or a crest kind of refers to the stable upland position. Okay, generally there's not a lot of slope gradient, relatively flat, and as far as what we associate with this is landscape stability. All right, and landscape stability translates into more soil development. So this idea of a crest or a summit would be where you would, all other factors being equal, where you would expect to see the greatest amount of soil development on the landscape. And by development, we mean the maximum horizonation, accumulation of clay, those types of things. Now, if we move to the shoulder, this is the one where the slope starts to break, or it's what we would characterize as the most actively downwearing position on a landscape. And typically, that's where you're going to find parent material closest to the surface because of that convexity. And as a result, the more often than not, if you're on a shoulder, you're going to see fairly shallow soil development relative to the other positions on that hill slope. And that's just because the active downwearing, a lot of this material is getting removed as fast as it weathers, so you the overall net amount of soil development is not that great. Backslope, this is that long, more or less linear type of slope that connects the shoulder and the lower slope positions. And this is what the process we associate with this is transportation. And it can be mineral material, it can be solutes, soil water, anything dissolved in that soil water. And here's a couple of examples. This is one of our local soils up here at the top image, and one of these perched water tables that we've talked a little bit about, sitting on top of a frangipan. And this water, is the net movement is going to be down that hill or from right to left in there. So you're transporting a lot of water from the summit or the crest up there into the lower slope positions. So it really is characterized by movement through, and it's not just pure water, but it of course has dissolved constituents in it. So there's a net flux of material through that backslope from upper slope positions into lower slope positions. This image right here just shows what that might look like when it dries out. You see the E-horizon there that's poking up, that's on top of that frangipan. So, and that's a pretty good indicator that there's been a lot of movement through there, right? And we talked about this last week with the monoliths, where you have this water moving on top of a frangipan, as in this situation, and as it moves, it strips out clays, it strips out iron oxides, and even some organic matter, and as a result, you end up with this white E-horizon that's very continuous over that hill slope. And in terms of, I guess another way of thinking of it is just through flow, or this movement of water and even solutes across or down that back slope. Well, then that brings us to the foot slope. So this is where you're coming down the slope, and all of a sudden the slope gradient is going to start to decrease a little bit. And so for the foot slope, we think of it as the zone of accumulation. So all this stuff that's being transported down the back slope is going to end up somewhere. A lot of it ends up in a foot slope. And if you think about what those are, mineral materials, solutes, water. A couple of examples of foot slope position. This one is in a base of a steeper slope where gravity is moving materials down there. And this is what we call colluvium. Also, when you get into the foot slope area, you start typically seeing water tables that are closer to the surface. So in many cases, those are going to be your wetter soils or moister soils with higher water tables. You may have the accumulation of mineral material up at the top, or that cumulization going on. But these would be some of the characteristics of the foot slope. And same thing with the toe slope. I'm not sure it's really important to break those two out, because they're real similar in terms of the types of processes. Well, there are some general relationships between the landscape and slopes and where we find a water table. And these are illustrated in this figure out of your book. The top part here represents, maybe the more typical type of relationship. And this would be in an area where you've got pretty good relief. In other words, like the Palouse, where you're there's a fair amount of elevation difference from the higher points on the landscape to the lower points on the landscape. So what we would, here's a hill slope, not much of a summit or crest expressed there, but so here's a river on either side, and these dotted lines show the positions of the landscape, or the positions of the water table on that landscape. And you can see that the most well-drained soils are going to be in the center part of that, right? It's going to be deepest down to that water table. And as you start to come down the slope and get into the foot slope position and adjacent to stream or river, then you've got that water table pretty close to the surface. Not very surprising. The second model down here on the bottom is areas that I call topographically challenged. In other words, areas where you don't see much difference in elevation between the high points and the low points on the landscape. And I think the model for this would be some of the coastal plains that you might find in the southeastern United States, where the difference between these two rivers in terms of horizontal distance, this may be several miles, and this elevation of this interfluve, as it's known, may just be a few feet. And the net result is you don't get much hydraulic gradient. And as a result, the water table tends to be the highest when you get out here in the center part of the landscape, just because there's so little hydraulic gradient from there down to the river or stream. And so, surprisingly, you go out to the highest point, center part of the landscape, and that's where you're going to find the really wet, poorly drained soils. And as you can see in the diagram, the better drained soils are going to be sort of on this edge. And then, of course, as you get down close to the stream or river, you'll get into the more poorly drained soils again. So two different situations of water tables and how that might relate to the land surface. This one up top is definitely more of what we would see here in the Palouse region, though. And just this example here, these are the two soils that you might find on this landscape here in the center and over here on the edge. And you can tell by the colors, the profile on the left. Is that a well-drained soil? Nope, not at all. So this sits out in the center of the interfluve, and then this is one of the edge soils. Same parent material and everything, it's just a difference in drainage. And that's what it's going to look like. It's a pretty striking difference in terms of morphology and more specifically color. Okay, the last thing I want to mention about slope gradient, or about landscape positions related to slope gradient, before we get on to the parent material. And actually, this is a really simple concept that I think most of you can grasp real easily. But if you have a nearly level slope like this, and imagine the incident precipitation that strikes, let's just say it's rainfall, okay? Where is the majority of that rain going to go once it hits the soil surface? It's going to move into the soil, right? Now, as we start to turn this to a much steeper gradient, and imagine the same thing, rain coming down, what's going to happen to the proportion of rain that actually will move into the soil versus what runs off? Well, and then we're going to find less moving into the soil and much greater tendency for it to run off the surface. And when you start having soils on steep slopes and you get more runoff, that also equates to more erosion and more removal of material. So all things being equal, do you get a more developed soil on a nearly level surface or a strongly sloping surface? Yeah, definitely on the level surface. And what we do is talk about slope gradient. And typically we just say, we call it percent slope. Engineers like to use degrees when they talk about slope steepness. Soil scientists use percent slope. And it's simply, imagine this is the slope. Put a person out here on it. Put a tree. You know, if you imagine you're looking up this slope, it's simply the
what some folks call the rise over the run expressed as a percent. So it's the difference in vertical distance versus the horizontal distance. And that's what we call percent slope. So that's something that if you're out on the site, you should definitely be able to estimate to the degree possible the percent slope. And sometimes it's just a matter of taking your arm like this and then trying to get it calibrated to the or lined up with the slope, and then you think of it as a right triangle like that and see if you can come up with a rise over run type of figure. Not too difficult to do, but still pretty important.
I know.
Well, yeah, if you have a clinometer, smartphones now have clinometers on them. There are a lot of ways you can do it. Some people used to take a protractor and put a weight on it, and then you'd use it to sight up the slope and look at what the angle was. But any way that works. Okay, so I want to move on and talk about parent material. And with parent material, there are two aspects that are really important in terms of soil formation and the soil properties that come from a particular parent material. The first aspect of parent material that we got to think about is simply its mineralogy. And that's the mineralogy of the rocks that are present or the sediment, whatever that parent material is. You know, is it dominated by quartz? Is it dominated by feldspars? What's the mineralogical and chemical makeup of that stuff? The second part of it has to do with the process by which that parent material is emplaced. And what I mean by that is that material carried in by running water? Is it carried in by wind? Is it transported by gravity? Is it transported by glacial ice? You've got a lot of different possibilities there for how that deposit, or what I like to call a surficial deposit, got emplaced, and that often has a big bearing on the characteristics of the soil as well. And I'll show you some examples of that. This next figure is simply the map of the 12 soil orders on the top, and then here's the generalized geology of the United States and the bottom. And like these other small-scale maps I've shown you, you can see the general patterns and associations between certain soil types and the geology. And as usual, you get out in the western United States and it's a mess. Not so much in the east. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the mineralogical characteristics of parent materials. And normally, we think about this with regard to rocks. And it doesn't necessarily have to be, but these are probably some of the cleanest examples to use. And if you think about the rock known as granite, you see in the lower image here, everybody's familiar with granite, right? Well, how many of you have heard the term rhyolite? Okay, and what do you know about rhyolite? Anything you can...
Volcanic ash that's been compressed, or...
It's a volcanic rock.
Mm-hmm. It's great for climbing.
It good for climbing? Okay. Well, the fact is, rhyolite and granite are exactly the same type of rock in terms of their composition and the mineral components. They have similar amounts of quartz, feldspars, accessory minerals, hornblendes, things like that. The difference is, rhyolite is what we call an extrusive rock, meaning that it formed as molten material or lava was extruded up at the Earth's surface. So that means that it cools pretty quickly, whereas granite is what we term an intrusive rock, meaning that it cools underneath the Earth's surface. And the difference is because of the different amount of time that it takes for these things to cool, the rhyolite being extrusive cools very quickly and you do not get large mineral grains. Okay? The granite cools relatively slowly, and this allows all of the elements that are in that melt or that magma to arrange themselves, and you end up with pretty large crystals like you can see in this picture. So rhyolite is a fine-grained rock and granite is a coarse-grained rock. They're equivalent in terms of mineralogical composition, but they're very different in terms of grain size, and that's actually the distinguishing feature. So as that rhyolite and granite are going to weather, you would expect that the rhyolite is going to give rise to a relatively finer textured soil, whereas the granite, we typically expect very sandy soils to develop from that. So something as basic as soil texture is often going to be directly attributable to the characteristics of that parent material. Another example, sandstone and shale. Sandstone, the name suggests it's dominated by what size particles? Sands, right? And shale, if you've studied shale in a geology course, it's essentially clay-sized particles that are composing it. So as these things weather, in terms of the texture, you'd expect the sandstone to give rise to very sandy type soils, whereas the shale, you're going to end up with much clayier material as a starting point. Remember the term lithosequence? We talked about the soil forming factors and how you might have a situation where you've got soils that have formed in under exactly the same conditions, or essentially the same conditions with respect to climate and organisms and the time, soil age, and topography, but they differ in terms of the parent material. And we would call this a lithosequence. This is a figure out of your book that shows a lithosequence in North Carolina. And looking at three different parent materials here, this one on the left is called, they describe it as a mica gneiss. Gneiss is a type of metamorphic rock. And it's a mica gneiss, meaning that mica is one of the major components in it. In the center here is what they call a hornblende gneiss, which is also a metamorphic rock, but hornblende is one of the major components. And then finally over here, diorite and gabbro, which are different types of volcanic rocks. Well, the point that they're making here is that each of these parent materials has a different soil series that is associated with it. Okay, so this would be the example of the lithosequence. And I have pictures of two of the end members. The one on the left would be the mica gneiss, and this is what we would call a felsic parent material, and I'll come back to that. We'll talk a little bit more about what that means. But notice the horizonation and the colors there. This would be the diorite, or the what would be a more mafic parent material, the one on the right. So these soils are the same age, pretty much same vegetation, same sort of landscape position and all that, but you can see the different morphology there, just as strictly a function of the parent material. Okay, a couple more examples. We're talking about texture and the effect that the parent material has on the texture soil. There's also some other considerations, like here, a couple rocks, limestone, very common sedimentary rock made up of what? Can be, but chemically it would be calcium carbonate primarily. Metamorphic rock, common around here, known as quartzite, made up of primarily quartz, right? Yeah, it's just been metamorphosed to some degree. Well, and quartz, what's the formula for quartz? SiO2. So if you're a plant, all other things being equal, would you rather be growing in a soil derived from a limestone or a quartzite parent material? Limestone. Why?
It says right here. High fertility.
Well, yeah, you think about it. Limestone, calcium, magnesium, carbonates, primarily the chemical composition, quartzite, SiO2. And if you want to translate that into fertility, certainly much greater fertility associated with limestone. So this is going to affect the plant community that is associated with that particular soil. And again, that in turn will affect the way, the amount of carbon that's added and the way in which it's added and so on. So the mineralogy, the chemical composition of parent material can have a huge effect on the plant communities that develop there as a result of fertility. Serpentinite, some of you may have seen this before. It's a rock that's characterized by having a lot of serpentine, which is a green mineral. If you drive down towards Riggins along the Salmon River there, and you'll see these nice outcrops of green rock down there, that is serpentinite. It's a real unusual mineral in that it has lots of magnesium, and it also has some heavy metals in it, and not much calcium. But it ends up being a very interesting parent material in areas because it gives rise to what are referred to as barrens, like you see here in this next picture. So that's a serpentine ridge that we're looking at right there. And you can see there's not much growing on it. And it's a parent material that would have a lot of fertility issues. Another characteristic of serpentine is you just find a lot of endemic plants that grow on it because I think this is Idaho phlox, and this is a Darlingtonia, one of the wetland plants that you find over on the west side of the Cascades. But these are almost exclusively associated with these serpentine-containing parent materials. But lots of endemic plants that or plant communities that are very unique that respond to these types of differences in parent material.
What was the one on the left?
I think it's called Darlingtonia, pitcher plant. Texas is an interesting example of a lot of things, and one of them is soils and parent materials. Some of you may remember from intro soils that 80% of the verdisols that are present in the United States are found in Texas. And the reason is because of the parent materials. If you look at these coastal sediments, these marine clayey sediments that were buried in a shallow ocean once upon a time, now they've been raised up, and sea level's gone down, so these things are exposed. And if you look at the verdisols, which show up here in blue, you can match these up with the parent materials or these clayey marine sediments. And so this is why Texas has got so many verdisol. It's directly a result of the parent material that's there. The other thing about parent materials that has had a big influence in the United States is kind of illustrated by this map. You can see all the different colors on here, the yellows and the reds, greens, and so on. What these colors represent are all the areas that have been either directly or indirectly affected by glaciation in the lower 48 states. And you can see it's a pretty sizable area, especially New England, the upper Midwest, and then you can see across the northern tier of states and then the higher elevations in the Rocky Mountains where you had more localized glaciation. But the point is that when we start thinking about glacial parent materials, they are pretty important in this country. And maybe another way to think about it, where's a lot of the agricultural production like the Corn Belt? Well, that would sort of be centered in this area. It's all on these soils that have formed in different types of glacial deposits, glacial tills, and that sort of thing. So, that's not a coincidence either. Because if you think about a glacier and the way that it might move, it's not unlike a bulldozer. So imagine you've got these gigantic bulldozers up in Canada moving south, and what they're doing is pushing all this rock material along. This rock material is ground up into finer and finer stuff, and all of this gets deposited down here in the United States. So we have these soils that are formed in glacial till. There's also a lot of loess soils that are found in the glacial areas, and these turn out to be extremely good agricultural soils. Whereas up in Canada, it doesn't show on this map, but imagine these landscapes that the bulldozer went over and just scraped everything down to bedrock, and they're miserable agricultural soils. And in fact, they probably can't even be used for agriculture. in many cases. So if you think about this whole business of continental glaciation over the last 2 million years, the United States came out smelling like a rose, as they say. It's really been beneficial to us. And I've always thought that it's fortunate that this glaciation took place before there were lawyers around, because you start thinking about some of the implications, you know, Canada suing us because we've got all of their ground up rock material now, and we're using it for agriculture, lost income, all kinds of aspects. This would be in the courts for years and years and years. And let's take a real quick look at parent materials around here and a little bit about our geologic history. I think a lot of you know this. Here's the map of the region, Lake Missoula over here, that formed as a result of an ice dam on the Clark Fork River. And this is from the continental ice that came down from Canada. And periodically, this glacial Lake Missoula would build up. At some point, they estimate about 500 cubic miles of water backed up behind this ice dam. And some of you that went on the field trip last fall, we talked about how ice makes a pretty lousy dam. Number one, it floats, and secondly, it's subject to melting. So it's not a good long-term dam. So periodically, this dam would fail, and you get this huge release of waters down through what we call the channel scablands today. And then this little spot down here, Wallula Gap, it's a very narrow constriction that the Columbia River goes through. And so all this water and sediment that it's carrying pours down through here, it hits the Wallula Gap, it gets backed up into southeastern Washington, and eventually that sediment settles out here and the winds pick it up and blow it back towards the Palouse. So that's kind of the short of it. And all of this lust that we have in the Palouse probably started out as what folks refer to as glacial flour. As these glaciers are moving, they're grinding up all this rock material. The meltwaters and the floodwaters carry it. If you've ever seen a stream that's coming out of an area with glaciers in it, it's got that milky appearance because of all the siltsonized stuff in it. The wind picks it up then and blows it, and we end up with lust deposits. Like we've got here in the Palouse, you can see in this map, all of these brown areas are large areas of lust. So in addition to all of that glacial material, or the glacial deposits that's on the previous map, we have all these lust soils that are at least indirectly related to glaciation. And some of the most productive agricultural lands that we've got in the United States as a result of it. So once again, we really made out well as a result of all this. You know, our nice deep Palouse silt loam that you see there, and the high water holding capacity, and the great dry land wheat yield. So, all right, I'm going to stop, and then we will, this Thursday in lab, we'll consider parent materials just a little bit more detail. And then on Thursday in here, we'll talk about time as a soil forming factor. And what I would encourage you to do, how many people looked at the old tests? Okay, does anybody have questions about them? Questions on the questions? Well, I'm willing to spend a little time on Thursday in here. If you've got some questions, bring them along with you. And chances are, if you're wondering about it, there are other people who are too. So it'd be a good opportunity to ask.